Welcome to Consensus and Controversies on Clinical Management, Future Perspectives, and Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. I'm Christopher Flowers, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues, Dr. Jennifer Brown, Dr. Weirda, and Dr. Jennifer Wyack. So in preparation for the meeting, each of us on the panel reviewed a number of cases along with three other experts in the field, Dr. Matthew Davids, Dr. Jonathan Friedberg, and Dr. Brad Call, who reviewed each of these cases and provided their responses to questions. So we will start with a few cases that review some of the controversies for patients in the frontline setting for chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So in our first case, here are responses from the audience about what's your usual preferred initial regimen for a 60-year-old patient with IGVH-mutated chronic lymphocytic leukemia who does not have evidence of deletion 17p and requires treatment? So for this, maybe we'll have Dr. Weirda walk us through how you would approach this patient who's a 60-year-old with CLL and no 17p deletion who requires treatment.
All right, so 60 years old is generally considered younger in terms of patients with CLL. That's important because we think about age with regard to myelosuppressive regimens and whether they can tolerate a more intensive regimen like FCR. 17P is very important to test for patients prior to initiating therapy, 17P and mutations in TP53, because we know if patients have those defects, a defect in 17P or a mutation in TP53, chemoimmunotherapy is really not indicated. So testing for 17P, TP53 mutations, and also knowing the immunoglobulin V gene status is important because we have seen with our MD Anderson long-term follow-up, and others have reported, the German CLL study group, including also the Italian group, have reported long-term follow-up with FCR and showing a plateau on the progression-free survival curve for about 50% of the patients who are non-progressors longer than 10 years following chemoimmunotherapy among those patients who get FCR and who have a mutated immunoglobulin gene. So today, with the data that we have, FCR would be probably the most appropriate treatment for that type of patient. Now, one question is, can you achieve the same thing with non-chemoimmunotherapy-based treatment? And I think we need to wait a little bit longer for the follow-up. And that's why I selected FCR first, and then perhaps venetoclax-based therapy will prove to be as effective.
And Dr. Wyack, it sounds like you would approach the both mutated and unmutated patients a little bit differently. How would you think about that?
Yeah, so based on the ECOG data that compared ibrutinib plus rituximab to FCR in young, previously untreated CLL patients, I think that ibrutinib would be a fine regimen to treat these younger, fit patients with. As Dr. Weirda said, there are patients who are IGVH mutated that have the potential for cure with FCR. From the ECOG study at this time, it doesn't look like the survival curves are any different for those IGVH mutated patients, whether they were treated with IR or FCR, but that's because nobody relapsed in either group. So these are patients that are going to likely do well with whatever treatment option you choose, and I actually think that all regimens are probably appropriate for these patients, and long-term follow-up will help us decide if one is really superior.
So let's move on to the next clinical situation. What about an older patient, a 75-year-old gentleman with IGVH-mutated CLL, without 17P deletion or TP53 mutation who requires treatment? It seems like the majority of the audience would use ibrutinib in this particular situation, although another group would think about chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. How would you approach this patient, Dr. Brown?
Right. So this patient having a mutated IGVH does have a variety of options. We know from the Alliance data that ibrutinib or ibrutinib rituximab had equal efficacy, so you don't need the rituximab, but ibrutinib would be a fine option for that patient. The chemoimmunotherapy arm of BR was also similar to the ibrutinib arm in a mutated IGVH patient, not so in an unmutated patient. So if you do want to consider chemoimmunotherapy for whatever reason, it's really more in the mutated patient. I think most of us feel that this patient, the best choice would either be a BTK inhibitor or very few people in the audience selected venetoclax or obinutuzumab. We now have some very nice data in older patients with comorbidities that venetoclax or obinutuzumab, 1 year of therapy, has an 88% two-year progression-free survival, which is identical to the two-year progression-free survival with ibrutinib in the Alliance study. The group of experts was really split whether they do a BTK inhibitor or venetoclax obinutuzumab.
And Dr. Wyatt, why ibrutinib for this type of patient?
Yeah, I think that both options really would do well with this patient. I really favor a BTK inhibitor right now just because we have a lot more long-term follow-up data on those patients. So the CLL14 study with venetoclax obinutuzumab, it was treatment for 1 year, and then we really have data for only 1 year off therapy. And so as that data matures, I would feel more comfortable with venetoclax obinutuzumab, but right now I would, for most patients, do a BTK inhibitor.
Let's move on to another clinical situation. So now we have a 60-year-old patient who has deletion 17P who requires treatment. It looks like the majority would choose a BTK inhibitor in that situation, either ibrutinib alone or ibrutinib in combination with obinutuzumab. A few folks would choose venetoclax and rituximab. Dr. Weirda, how would you approach this particular type of patient?
So the patient, again, is relatively young. They have a 17P deletion. 17P deletion was a very high-risk feature when we were using chemoimmunotherapy. Although we have very effective treatments now with the targeted therapy, they're still higher risk than the non-17P or mutated TP53 population, which means they have a shorter progression-free survival, and they will likely fail whatever treatment you're giving them sooner than they would if they didn't have a 17P. So for a 60-year-old, I'm thinking long-term, and I'm thinking about what I'm going to use, what's the sequence going to be, and perhaps transplant down the line may be an option. So for a 60-year-old with 17P deletion, my preference would be to give ibrutinib or a BTK inhibitor-based therapy. We have longer follow-up data with the BTK inhibitors in that setting than with the BCL2 small molecule inhibitors. I would expect to have several years of progression-free survival with ibrutinib-based therapy. And that allows me to use down the line venetoclax as a salvage treatment in this type of patient. And the reason why that's appealing to me is that I'm thinking, well, maybe transplant is a reasonable option down the line, and I like the option of venetoclax, which is very effective at debulking the disease in preparation for transplant. So I think the long-term view for this type of patient is an important view, and thinking about how you're going to sequence them for this particular type of patient is important.
And Dr. Brown, how do you choose between BTK inhibitors in this particular situation or in general in the front line?
So I agree very much with Bill's approach to the patients. You know, I have been tending to use a little more acalabrutinib off-label just based on what my experience has been of improved tolerability. In a 60-year-old, I don't think it matters that much, but as the patients get older, we had the 75-year-old patient, there you see a lot more cardiac toxicity. So as the patients get older, I would veer more toward the acalabrutinib. But for this patient, it's not. Obviously, if the patient has comorbidities that include, you know, need for ongoing anticoagulation, pre-existing atrial fibrillation, pre-existing cardiac disease, bleeding diathesis, those would be specific reasons why you might choose acalabrutinib up front.
Let's move on to the question of minimal residual disease testing for patients with CLL. We asked the audience, how often have you ordered a minimal residual disease test to assess patients with CLL and to guide your treatment decisions? It looks like about two-thirds of the audience have not done that, but about a third have. So what's the role of minimal residual disease testing, Dr. Wyack, in patients with CLL, and how do you utilize it?
Well, it definitely depends on the therapy. So we know with BTK inhibitors, very, very few patients are going to achieve minimal residual disease negativity, especially in the relapse setting, but even in the frontline setting too. It also doesn't appear that the achievement of MRD negativity means anything in terms of long-term progression-free survival. So I don't think with a BTK inhibitor, MRD testing is useful. We know with chemoimmunotherapy, there's a lot of data to show that patients who get a deeper remission, including MRD negativity, are the ones who tend to do better long-term, including the patients who have the potential for cure with FCR. Venetoclax, from the data that we have so far, either alone or in combination with CD20 antibodies, appears to be similar to chemoimmunotherapy in that regard, where patients who achieve MRD negativity have a longer PFS and significantly probably a longer progression-free survival off therapy when you choose to stop. So I tend to use it in patients who are receiving venetoclax venetoclax-based therapy, especially if I'm thinking that I'm going to stop. And, you know, predominantly in those patients who are treated with ibrutinib and then treated with venetoclax, in that situation, I usually won't stop if the patient is MRD positive.
And Dr. Weirder, anything different in the way that you manage patients with venetoclax with minimal residual disease? And how easy is it to order minimal disease testing out in the community in your experience?
So I can think of two examples where I would use MRD outside of a clinical trial. One is if I'm getting a young patient with a mutated V gene FCR, and I will check after 3 cycles MRD in the bone marrow. I will also do a CAT scan. If they don't have any nodes over 1.5 centimeters and their bone marrow is MRD negative, I will stop treatment in that example because we've done work, retrospective work, to show that that patient probably doesn't need 3 more cycles of chemotherapy. The other example would be from the Murano data and the longer-term follow-up from the Murano data, which is venetoclax rituximab in the relapse setting. At the end of the 2-year venetoclax-based therapy, there's 2 groups of patients who are at higher risk for shorter progression-free survival when you stop venetoclax. One are patients who have a 17p deletion, the other are patients who are MRD positive at the end of that 2-year time point. So we'll check MRD at that time point, and probably I would be inclined to do blood in that setting. If they're MRD positive, then I'll continue the venetoclax-based therapy because I'd worry about earlier progression.
And how easy it is to get MRD testing in the community?
Yeah. So in the community, I'm not so sure. For us, it's easy because our clinical lab will do it routinely. We do it by 6-color flow cytometry in our clinical flow lab. I don't think it's difficult, though, from what I've heard from my community colleagues.
And Dr. Brown, can you explain a little bit more about what MRD actually is and what's being tested and how are these different tests performed?
Right, so MRD, minimal residual disease, is a way of looking for subtle remaining CLL cells that are below our standard clinical detection level. And the standard approach in CLL generally uses flow cytometry, which had originally been standardized for 4-color flow cytometry with sensitivity of at least 1 cell in 10,000 or 10 to the minus fourth. We often now use more extended colors. And it can also be done by PCR, and people are also investigating next-generation sequencing. The next-generation sequencing approaches are, I think, of great interest right now and potentially increase the sensitivity from 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6 as we're trying to move toward cure with some of these regimens. But the flow-based assay would be the standard approach, but it isn't done in most clinical labs. The sensitivity does not reach the 10 to the minus 4 required for the MRD testing, so you need a specifically validated MRD assay.
So let's move on to our last case in this series. So for a patient with newly diagnosed CLL who you decide to administer upfront venetoclax therapy, what would be your most likely approach if the patient was MRD positive after completing 1 year of therapy, getting to the points that we just heard about with MRD testing? So it looks like about half of the audience would continue treatment, 18% would discontinue therapy, and another about a third or less have not used venetoclax in this upfront treatment setting. So, Dr. Wyack, tell us a little bit about how you use MRD testing in this setting.
It looks like the group was fairly split on this. I would tend to stop treatment whether the patient was MRD positive or negative because the CLL14 study didn't use MRD testing as a reason to continue or stop therapy. You know, in this frontline group of patients, we don't know as much. You know, in the patients from the Murano study where they were treated for 2 years and then stopped therapy, patients who were MRD positive had a shorter progression-free survival. That's probably going to be the case with the upfront therapy too, but I don't know that we're sure that we get a lot of benefit from continuing the venetoclax in those patients, which is why I would stop.
Maybe tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are about what are the patients where it might be appropriate to consider ibrutinib plus rituximab over ibrutinib or chemoimmunotherapy alone. Are there any situations where you think about that?
Yeah, I think there are very few reasons to choose ibrutinib plus rituximab over ibrutinib alone, or really ibrutinib plus a CD20 antibody. The couple times that I have used that regimen are in patients who have a need for therapy, but also a pretty significant autoimmune disease. You know, whether it is autoimmune hemolytic anemia, skin toxicities, vasculitis, things like that. I've used that in a few cases for those types of patients. And as well, the very, very infrequent patient that comes with such a high white blood cell count that I'm a little bit nervous about giving ibrutinib alone. And for me, that tends to be like over 600,000 or so.
So let's move on to our second module about acalabrutinib and other novel strategies for patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Let's start off again with some cases. So our first is a patient who requires treatment at initial workup, finds that there is a TP53 mutation. And if the result's positive, what would the approach for treatment be? Is that the same as what you would use for deletion 17P or different? About 82% of you agree that you would use the exact same approach as what you would use for 17P deletion. So maybe Dr. Weerda, tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are. It looks like there's consensus across the board about this.
Yeah, so I would agree that there is consensus, and we generally think of those patients similarly, patients who have a 17p deletion and patients who have mutated TP53. If you look and do TP53 mutation analysis, if you look at a group of patients with 17p deletion, more than 90% of them will probably have a mutation in TP53. We find about 5% of patients will have mutated TP53 without 17p deletion, so it's or less than 5%. It's a low frequency, but I think it's notable enough that I would do mutation analysis for TP53 and 17p if considering chemoimmunotherapy. We do not use chemoimmunotherapy in patients with 17p or mutated TP53. That's the most important time to do that testing if you're thinking about a chemoimmunotherapy-based regimen.
So we know that asymptomatic patients with 17p deletion have a likelihood of needing therapy in less than a year. Dr. Brown, ever a situation where you think about treating one of those patients just based on their 17p deletion?
No, and that is continuing to be the case because there is a distinct subset of those patients who actually don't progress rapidly toward therapy. They often have some mitigating factor, like they may have a mutated IGVH or they don't have a complex karyotype. But that being said, patients who don't meet criteria for treatment, even with a 17p deletion, can often go many years until they meet criteria for treatment. And so it's still not indicated to start therapy early before patients need treatment.
So let's move on. We asked the audience, what's your usual preferred initial therapy for a 60-year-old individual with deletion 17P who requires treatment and has a history of atrial fibrillation and is receiving anticoagulation therapy? About 28% said acalabrutinib, 25% venetoclax plus rituximab, and an even spread across a number of other potential options. So Dr. Wyatt, how would you approach this patient who has atrial fibrillation and has 17P deletion?
Well, I'm with the audience on this one, and I would probably consider acalabrutinib for this patient. I think that a BTK inhibitor is an appropriate option for this patient with 17p deletion. Acalabrutinib has a lower risk of atrial fibrillation, at least with the data that we've seen so far, than ibrutinib does. And I've had a lot of success in patients who develop atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib, switching them over to acalabrutinib and not having return of the atrial fibrillation. So I would choose acalabrutinib in this patient. And I don't actually think that there's much difference in the bleeding risk between the two, so it's really the AFib and not the anticoagulation that would make me choose acalabrutinib.
And Dr. Brown, you like me that you would give venetoclax to obinutuzumab for this particular type of patient. How would you think about that and rationalize that choice?
So it's really based on the comorbidities and likely the anticoagulation more than the atrial fibrillation. But I would also consider acalabrutinib. It's always a discussion. And the audience was pretty split between a venetoclax-based regimen and acalabrutinib, either of which I think is reasonable.
So let's move on to our next case. So this is a 60-year-old patient who's responding to ibrutinib, but then eventually develops atrial fibrillation on therapy and requires anticoagulation with warfarin. What would you most likely recommend in this situation? And it looks like 36% would use acalabrutinib, about 18% venetoclax and rituximab, and 23% would continue ibrutinib at the same dose, and some would continue ibrutinib at a reduced dose. So Dr. Weerda, how do you think about this type of patient?
So a young patient, 17p deletion, I'm thinking long-term, I want to keep the patient on target for as long as I can, so I'd like to be able to maintain the patient on a BTK inhibitor-based therapy for as long as I can and then switch them if they become refractory. So we don't use ibrutinib in combination with warfarin, but we do use ibrutinib in combination with other anticoagulants. So my preference would be to switch patient off warfarin and continue the ibrutinib.
just to keep the patient in class of drug.
Anything that you'd do different for this patient, Dr. Wyatt?
No, and actually my answer was incorrect. I would also switch their anticoagulation, but I would change it to acalabrutinib. I think that, in my experience, the rate of atrial fibrillation is lower on acalabrutinib, and like I said before, I've switched a lot of patients from ibrutinib to acalabrutinib with AFib and had some success doing that.
And it looks like there's a question from the audience about the use of anti-CD20 in the frontline. Why is anti-CD20 given for 6 cycles when given in combination with ibrutinib? Is there a strong rationale for that other than the fact that 6 is the magic number that we use for everything?
Yep, 6 is the magic number. Actually, for the Alliance study, it was designed so that the dose of rituximab in the IR arm was similar to what was in the BR arm, and then it was based upon the study that Jan Berger from MD Anderson had done initially with ibrutinib rituximab, and we used pretty much the same regimen.
So let's go on to our next question to the audience. So have you or would you use acalabrutinib as initial therapy for CLL outside of a trial setting? It looks like 5% have, a little bit less than 2/3 have not, but they would for the right patient, and about 1/3 have not and would not use this in this particular situation. So Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit about how you would approach the use of acalabrutinib.
Right. So we've already discussed that in general, acalabrutinib has an improved safety profile compared to ibrutinib, certainly with respect to atrial fibrillation. That's what we feel, at least from our non-comparative data so far in one randomized trial. We'll soon have more randomized data on that subject. I tend to think that there's somewhat less bleeding, although there's certainly still bleeding with acalabrutinib. And so for patients with those comorbidities, acalabrutinib is potentially a preferred choice. The toxicities of ibrutinib, as we can see from comparing the ECOG and Alliance studies, tend to increase with increasing age. And so as you get an older patient with more comorbidities, especially cardiac comorbidities, those patients I tend to lean more toward acalabrutinib as well, because I've had many have to come off rapidly for cardiac toxicity.
So it looks like there's general consensus across our panel of experts. Dr. Friedberg tends to agree with you that for a patient with atrial fibrillation or perhaps one that you might be considering anticoagulation or intolerance to ibrutinib for another reason, he would use acalabrutinib in exactly those situations. And it looks like the rest of us generally would think about using that for the right kind of patient for many of the same reasons that have already been mentioned. So what about clinical trial data and personal experience? How would you compare the tolerability and toxicity of acalabrutinib to that of ibrutinib in patients with CLL? It looks like 57% think that acalabrutinib has less toxicity. There's an even split between those who don't know or believe that there are not enough data to make a decision at this time, and about 8% who say that that's about the same. So Dr. Wyack, how do you view the toxicity of acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib, both in terms of efficacy and in terms of toxicity?
So I think, you know, there is quite a bit of safety data with acalabrutinib so far, including small studies where patients on ibrutinib who have intolerance are switched to acalabrutinib. And in general, the toxicities in that setting, the toxicities that patients have on ibrutinib are less on acalabrutinib. So I think that it is fairly clear that acalabrutinib has less toxicity. There are some toxicities that are probably class specific, like bleeding and bruising are seen with both agents. I agree with Dr. Brown that I think acalabrutinib has less bruising in my experience. When you look at the studies, like the rates of major bleeding on like time contemporary studies are pretty similar, I think, between the two drugs, but minor bleeding is a little bit better with acalabrutinib. In terms of efficacy, you know, the data would suggest so far that they're about the same. However, we're very lucky that there is a head-to-head study in patients with high-risk relapsed CLL that eventually will hopefully tell us if one of these is more effective than the other.
And so there are also some unique toxicities associated with acalabrutinib, headache being one of those. Dr. Brown, tell us a little about the headache that we see with acalabrutinib and how you think through that patient and how to manage that and whether that's a toxicity that might limit your ability to use the drug.
Well, it's generally an acute toxicity pretty soon after patients begin the drug, and it does generally go away relatively quickly in the first few weeks or maybe up to a month or two at the worst in my experience. It's usually pretty manageable with Tylenol or minimal supportive care. So the patient needs encouragement that this isn't going to last forever, I think, is a big part of the issue, because I haven't actually had to alter therapy in anyone for headache.
Yeah. Anything different from that,
No, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the comment that I would make with regard to distinguishing feature, I believe that they're similarly effective in managing the disease. We talk a lot about grade 3 or greater toxicities and AFib, et cetera. And for me, one of the distinguishing features has not been the higher grade toxicities, but the lower grade ones, the grade 1, the grade 2, and those that last for months at a time, arthralgias, myalgias, fatigue with ibrutinib that I have not seen with acalabrutinib. And that, for me, has been the main distinguishing feature between the use of those drugs and discontinuing ibrutinib for those types of toxicities where I haven't had to do that with acala.
I agree completely. And once you use the drug, that's what you really notice, that the patients are much less aware that they're taking something constantly. They have many fewer of these low-grade, extremely irritating AEs if you're on a drug forever.
And caffeine, have you ever used that for patients with the headache and acalabrutinib? I've heard that that's a remedy. Do you want to comment on that, Dr.?
Yeah, I've had that work for some patients, but not for everybody.
What do we know about cross-resistance between ibrutinib and acalabrutinib in terms of patients that relapse following ibrutinib?
Right. So in contrast to the ability to change patients who come off ibrutinib for adverse events to acalabrutinib, we know that patients who develop the cysteine 481 mutation on ibrutinib will not respond to acalabrutinib. And in fact, ibrutinib has more activity against that mutation than acalabrutinib does. So a patient who's progressed on ibrutinib is not a candidate for switching to another covalent inhibitor. Those non-covalent inhibitors that are in phase 1 studies would be considered, and we are testing those in that patient population. But we expect that resistance is the same for ibrutinib and acalabrutinib.
And what do we know about dosing and schedule for the different BTK inhibitors? So acalabrutinib is given twice daily. Does that have any complications for older patients or with therapy discontinuation? Dr. Wyack?
I think on the trials, it doesn't appear to be a detriment to have the twice daily dosing with acalabrutinib. And of course, like on a clinical trial where somebody is giving you a pill diary and reminding you to take the drug all the time, I think that that's what you would expect. It remains to be seen what happens when that's translated out into the setting where people are being prescribed acalabrutinib more often outside of a clinical trial, whether compliance will be as good as it is with a once daily dose drug, and as well whether a lack of compliance with acalabrutinib is going to make a difference with efficacy, because we know that the BTK occupancy with only once daily dosing of acalabrutinib, as Dr. Brown showed, is not as high as with twice daily dosing, and especially if you're only doing 100 milligrams once a day, that's not going to have a lot of BTK occupancy.
So Dr. Brown, you have experience with using acalabrutinib outside of the clinical trial space. What's that been like for you in terms of clinical practice with patients and the dosing schedule?
Most of my patients generally tell me that they think they can take a drug twice a day. It's much better than three times a day because yeah, they're already usually taking some medicines morning and night. So I haven't really noticed a problem or concern about that with most of my patients. But it is obviously a potential concern for greater noncompliance.
Great. Well, an exciting discussion and lots of new therapies in the frontline setting and more things on the horizon. So let's move on to the relapse and refractory setting for CLL. And let's first turn to the audience poll questions and the review and responses of experts. So reimbursement and regulatory issues aside, which second line therapy would you recommend for a 60-year-old patient with IGVH mutated CLL who doesn't have 17p deletion or TP53 mutation, who initially responded to FCR as the upfront therapy, and then experienced disease progression 3 years later? So it looks like the vast majority of the audience would use ibrutinib, a few that would use venetoclax and rituximab in this particular situation. And when we poll our experts, it looks like a little bit of a split between those two in terms of patients who had FCR as their upfront therapy in terms of venetoclax, rituximab, or ibrutinib. So Dr. Wyack, tell us a little bit about why you would use ibrutinib in this situation.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that both of these responses are correct, and I don't think that we really have any data to tell us that one is really better than the other. My preference for ibrutinib in this setting comes from, you know, they're a young patient, they're likely to tolerate it fairly well, they have very good risk features, so they're likely to go a very long time without relapsing. And we do have more data long-term with ibrutinib than with venetoclax rituximab, and we have more data for the sequence of ibrutinib than venetoclax rather than the other way around.
And Dr. Weirdo, why venetoclax rituximab in this particular situation and when someone relapses after FCR?
I mean, I can make an argument for either treatment. Venetoclax is a fixed duration treatment, so I think this patient is young and could benefit from a fixed duration treatment and coming off therapy after a couple years on venetoclax. It has activity, but like I said, and I agree with Jennifer, you can make an argument for either strategy. And there's not data that says one is better than the other.
And it looks like universally across the group of experts, if someone had ibrutinib as their frontline therapy, that venetoclax-based regimen would be utilized in the relapse setting, with the majority thinking the combination of venetoclax-rituximab in the relapse setting would be the preferred choice. So let's turn to an older patient in this exact same situation. So this is a 75-year-old woman with IGVH-mutated CLL who doesn't have 17p deletion or TP53 mutation, who initially responded to ibrutinib and then experienced disease progression 3 years later. So the majority of the group would either use some venetoclax-based regimen, either venetoclax alone, venetoclax plus rituximab, or venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. Acalabrutinib was favored by about 9% of the audience. So how do you think through this situation, Dr. Wyack?
I think in this situation, it's important to note that venetoclax is the only agent that has been shown in a clinical trial to be effective after ibrutinib. So I think venetoclax-based regimen is clearly the correct answer here. Alone or in combination with a CD20 antibody, you could probably argue different ways because the clinical trial that was done was venetoclax alone after ibrutinib, although there seems to be more efficacy with a CD20 antibody. And I think, generally most people are using venetoclax plus rituximab in the relapse setting based on the Murano data, probably obinutuzumab would be just fine as well. But I would tend to at least do 2 years of venetoclax treatment in this patient.
And Dr. Weirdo?
Just a couple comments. So in a patient who's been on ibrutinib and is progressing, they're probably having a rising white blood cell count. I put venetoclax rituximab, but then I realized if we're not thinking about regulatory and reimbursement issues, my thought would be that obinutuzumab venetoclax would be probably a better option clinically, because if you start the obinutuzumab first, you can usually get rid of the lymphocytosis with one cycle of obinutuzumab before you start the ramp up of venetoclax. That can make the ramp up of venetoclax a little bit easier. The other comment that I would make is, for these patients who are progressing on a BTK inhibitor, I worry about them. They have my attention, and so if you stop the BTK inhibitor, you can have disease that is very rapidly progressive. So for this type of patient, I would tend to continue the ibrutinib while starting and ramping up on the venetoclax, and then discontinue the ibrutinib once I'm up to what I think is an effective dose or an active dose of venetoclax, more than 200 milligrams daily, to avoid that rapid progression that you can see with discontinuation of a BTK inhibitor.
Yeah. So Dr. Wyack, your group has thought a lot about this and BTK resistance. How do you think about managing the ibrutinib through that time period when you're moving on to the next therapy?
Yeah, I actually do it exactly the same way Dr. Weirdo mentioned. I always overlap the ibrutinib with the venetoclax, at least until I get to the 400 milligram dose of venetoclax. And as well, I think it's important to think about these patients, like when you think that they're starting to progress on ibrutinib, I usually try to treat them sooner. I always try to treat them sooner rather than later, because many times they will progress slowly at first. And then when they start to progress very quickly, it can be really difficult to get them onto another regimen, even something effective like venetoclax.
So these are some of the nuances and tricks of the trade that experts use in exactly this situation that they never tell you in the package insert. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to our next case. So at approximately what creatinine clearance level do you consider a patient who's receiving venetoclax for CLL to be at higher risk for tumor lysis syndrome? So less than 60 milliliters by about 38%, less than 50, less than 40, less than 30, or less than 80 in a relatively small minority of the group. So how do you think through this process? Maybe we'll start with Dr. Brown.
Right. So it's a combination of both their disease burden at the time you're initiating the venetoclax, as well as their comorbidities and the extent of their renal function. I do follow the guidelines fairly religiously, or sometimes even add additional monitoring. And so you also have to balance, if you're talking about one of these patient cases where maybe you can choose a BTK, maybe you can choose venetoclax, but they have poor renal function, then that may be the case where you'd prefer to choose the BTK. or you may want to try cytoreducing with an antibody, as Bill had mentioned earlier, before you come in with the venetoclax. And it's important to get a CT scan so that you truly know what their tumor burden is as you're initiating the venetoclax, which isn't always done, so that you can follow the package insert guidelines.
Any way differently that you would think about this, Dr. White?
No, I agree. I think that it is really important to follow the guidelines for venetoclax escalation very religiously. I always get a CAT scan as well. And for me, I don't know that it necessarily matters exactly what their creatinine clearance is. It's kind of a gestalt, like Jennifer said, with the tumor burden, with how fit they are otherwise, how well they're going to tolerate the hydration and things like that, that helped me decide for some patients with kind of borderline renal function whether they should be inpatient or outpatient for the escalation.
And my answer is a little bit different from the rest of the group, and that's really based on a retrospective study that Anthony Mato published on a series of patients that were treated with venetoclax either on or off of clinical trials across a number of academic medical centers, where they looked across that series and within that series found that patients who had a creatinine clearance that was less than 80, that their risk of tumor lysis syndrome was in the 14% range, as opposed to those who were above 80, that it was about in the 5% range. And so that's the point where I start to worry a little bit about that. I may not do anything dramatically differently.
And I would agree with your number probably is the most correct, because the package insert indicates that if patients have a creatinine clearance of 80 or less, they should, and they have medium risk, you should consider managing them as a high-risk patient.
And I should clarify that I worry about everyone when I start venetoclax, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Anyone want to say a little bit about how you manage those patients, Dr. Wyack, a little bit differently?
Yeah, at Ohio State, we often will admit patients and do, as Dr. Davids had put in his comment there, an accelerated ramp up. There's not really any data for that right now, or any good data for that right now, but might be something in the future that gains popularity. But I think anything that is done like outside of the norm like that should definitely be done inpatient. And I always make sure that we're checking the tumor lysis labs very carefully.
Dr. Weirda, and maybe comment about community doctors and how they should manage these patients as well, and whether they should be hospitalized.
A couple things to remind people of. One is, as Jennifer said, it's important to have a good idea of the bulk of disease before you start. So a CT scan is an important part of that. Risk stratification is based on nodal size, which is determined by CT and by white blood cell count. We participated in the early phase 1 study and had deaths on the early phase 1 study due to tumor lysis syndrome. The risk mitigation and the process that we use is now very safe if you follow it. So it's important to be familiar and aware of how to initiate and escalate venetoclax. If you do it the way it is in the package insert, it's very safe. The level of laboratory tumor lysis syndrome is very low, and we very, very rarely see clinical tumor lysis. I think the other thing that's important to remind people of is to start allopurinol before you start venetoclax. We've seen some data suggesting that people are not as proactive about allopurinol, but all these patients, regardless of their risk, should be started on allopurinol, preferably several days before they start the venetoclax and through the ramp up.
Let's move on. So reimbursement, regulatory issues aside, which third-line therapy would you generally recommend for a 60-year-old patient with IGVH-mutated CLL without deletion 17P or TP53 mutation, who initially responds to bendamustine rituximab for 24 months, then experiences disease relapse, and then receives ibrutinib for 18 months, followed by disease progression? So it looks like no one would use chemoimmunotherapy in this situation, which I think is appropriate. Venetoclax and rituximab by about half, venetoclax and obinutuzumab for about another third, and then 19% would use venetoclax alone. So Dr. Brown, maybe walk us through this particular case and how you think about what regimen to use in this situation.
Right. Well, as we discussed earlier, if the patient is taking ibrutinib and has active disease progression while taking ibrutinib, then that's a situation for which we have good data with venetoclax. Venetoclax is the only drug we have good data in that setting. And we discussed earlier how we would all essentially usually add the venetoclax to the patient continuing on ibrutinib, because if you stop the ibrutinib, you can get explosive disease flare. So you can see the experts are all agreed venetoclax plus minus a CD20. I find that the CD20 often helps with that initial cytoreduction to get a response quickly if they have a significant disease burden in this actively progressing setting. It's a little bit different if the patient actually has come off ibrutinib for an adverse event, is stable for a bit, and then progresses later. But this person's had chemoimmunotherapy and ibrutinib, so that still venetoclax is the most active drug that you would use there. In theory, you could also consider a PI3 kinase inhibitor, but the data are not as strong.
And it looks like there's universal opinion across our panel of experts that venetoclax would be the appropriate choice. Two would use venetoclax as a single agent, but I think for the reasons that you very nicely outlined, I would use an anti-CD20 antibody in this particular situation. So let's move on to our last case in this module. So based on current clinical trial data and personal experience, how would you compare the global tolerability and toxicity of duvelisib to that of idelalisib in CLL? About 9% think they're about the same, 32% think that there's less toxicity, and a little bit less than half are not familiar with the use of duvelisib in this particular situation. So Dr. Wyack, tell me a little bit about how you think about the different PI3 kinase inhibitors and how those compare to each other.
So I think, the data so far would suggest that duvelisib and idelalisib are fairly similar in terms of tolerability as well as efficacy. I put that there's not enough available data because I don't think that there is really enough data to compare the two. There is not that much data for either one of them. I usually am using PI3 kinase inhibitors right now in, a carefully selected patient who couldn't take a BTK inhibitor, or occasionally in somebody who has progressed on ibrutinib, progressed on venetoclax, and needs something to kind of bridge to a clinical trial, though we know in that scenario it's not likely to be effective for that long of a period of time.
Right. And it sounds like there's universal agreement among our panel of experts that these are about the same in terms of efficacy and in terms of toxicity. Dr. Brett?
I would say that the toxicity profile may be a bit different in some respects, that duvelisib may have a bit more infection, but less transaminitis, less pneumonitis. The diarrhea colitis, which is what worries us so much, I think is about the same.
So it may be some new PI3 kinase inhibitors that are on the horizon that might change this, but by and large, it seems like these are class effects that we see across our agents, although with slightly different toxicities in terms of the way they manifest themselves in trials.
And another approach is to try different dosing schedules, which a number of companies are doing, intermittent schedules, right, to see if that
also. So I think that will tell us more about the best ways to use PI3 kinase inhibitors. Maybe we'll have some comments from the panel of our experts about when do you think about a PI3 kinase inhibitor in this setting. So Dr. Wyack?
Yeah, I think generally I will use a PI3 kinase inhibitor in kind of those double refractory patients as a planned bridge to something else, or occasionally, and somebody who really couldn't tolerate or was inappropriate for a BTK inhibitor.
Yeah. Dr. Brown, what do you think about that?
Right. So we've done some work suggesting that the toxicity level of PI3 kinase inhibitors is less with increasing age and also less among unmutated patients. And so I consider a good candidate to be an elderly patient who may particularly have some cardiac or renal comorbidities that make it not so easy to use BTK or BCL2, and I actually have used PI3 kinase inhibitors before one or the other of those drugs in that context with some success. It's also better if that patient happened to have had prior chemoimmunotherapy, which also reduces the risk of some of the immune toxicities.
And so you would think about that even sometimes in the second line regimen for some of those patients who've had chemoimmunotherapy and have these comorbidities?
Well, if they're elderly and have those comorbidities, yeah.
And Dr. Weirdo, when do you think about use of PI3 kinase inhibitors?
I mean, we worry about the toxicities associated with that class of drugs, and that's been the biggest challenge. The progression-free survival curves in the relapse setting are shorter. The median progression-free survival tends to be shorter than BTK inhibitor-based therapy and BCL2 small molecule inhibitor, so I tend to use it later in preference to those other two classes of drugs. But it has activity. It has activity in high-risk patients. I would not consider using it in a patient who is refractory to ibrutinib, who progresses on ibrutinib, because there is some data that indicates that there's not a lot of activity with another B-cell receptor signaling pathway inhibitor if patients develop resistance to, for example, a BTK inhibitor.
So, Dr. Brown, you alluded earlier that schedule may play a role in mitigating some of the toxicities of PI3 kinase inhibitors, and there have been some novel agents that have been used on other schedules in clinical trials. Maybe explain a little bit more about the role of schedule in these toxicities, and do you ever think about that when you're using a standard of care PI3 kinase inhibitor?
Right. So the concern is that PI3 kinase inhibitors may result in loss of Tregs, they're immunomodulatory, and that the continuous dosing sustains that. And so the question is if you could dose for an interval and then give a break, you might have some recovery of that immune function that might mitigate toxicity. And there are two sort of broad views one could take of that: to dose, say, for a week and then take several weeks off, almost like we did with chemoimmunotherapy, or you could dose for a couple days in a week and then take it the rest of the week off and then redose. But we don't have yet any biological basis for choosing one of those, so I haven't done that outside the context of a clinical trial. They're both being explored in clinical trials. In terms of clinical practice, mostly I would do a hold and dose reduction, but still use the drug continuously, since that's how both Adela and duvelisib are approved.
Great. So thank you to all of our panelists. This has really been an exciting discussion and a very exciting time and great horizon for CLL in the future with these agents.